This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
How would you love a chance to save some money on car insurance? GEICO can help. Switch today and see all the ways you could save with great rates and discounts. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com to get a rate quote and get started seeing how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, this morning with your host, Gordon Deal.
Deadly migrant smuggling. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. On this Tuesday, June 28th, glad you could be with us, and here's what we have for you this hour.
Authorities in Texas say 46 people were found dead inside a tractor trailer in San Antonio, one of the worst recent incidents of human smuggling.
The Supreme Court has ruled in favor of a former Seattle-area high school football coach who prayed in the middle of the field after games.
Pro-life advocates have a decision to make. How far should they press at the state level after the end of Roe v. Wade? We'll have analysis.
And how a shortage of pilots is contributing to airline reliability issues this summer.
It's not the only issue, but it is kind of the key issue. One of the experts who I spoke to for this story said that in the U.S. at least, the pilot shortage is the bottleneck that's kind of causing this cascading effect across the rest of the industry.
Zach Wichter at USA Today on the airline pilot shortage and how and when it might be fixed. Gruesome discovery in San Antonio, where at least 46 people, all believed to be migrants, have been found dead inside of a tractor trailer. Police said a nearby worker found a trailer with doors partially opened and saw a number of people deceased inside. 16 people, 12 adults and 4 children, have been taken to nearby medical facilities for further care. San Antonio Mayor Ron Nuremberg.
Plight of migrants seeking refuge is always a humanitarian crisis, but tonight we are dealing with a horrific human tragedy.
Authorities say those who were found alive were hot to the touch and suffering from heat stroke and exhaustion and were conscious when transported for care. There was no sign of water in the refrigerated tractor trailer and no visible working air conditioning unit. Temperatures in the San Antonio area, by the way, range from the high 90s to low 100s yesterday. Customs and Border Protection, by the way, counted more than 239,000 migrant encounters in May, eclipsing the previous record in April. At least 3 people have been killed and dozens more injured after an Amtrak train derailed in rural Missouri after colliding with a dump truck. The train was traveling from Los Angeles to Chicago with 243 passengers aboard. Amtrak said several of the company's Southwest Chief trains came off the tracks after the collision in Mendon, about 84 miles northeast of Kansas City. 7 of the train's 8 cars derailed. Passenger Jason Drinkard.
Seats were coming apart, bags were going everywhere. And then after it stopped, you could smell the fumes. And so people started panicking, thinking it was going to catch fire. So we tried to get out as quick as possible.
2 people died on the train. 1 died in the truck. The crash occurred at an uncontrolled intersection on a gravel road without lights or electronic controls. Passengers on the train included Boy Scouts who were traveling home to Appleton, Wisconsin, but no one in that group was seriously injured. In fact, the Scouts administered first aid to several injured passengers. For nearly half a century, that Roe v. Wade was the law of the land, the most prominent opponents of abortion often urged an incremental approach to narrowing access to the procedure. Now, having achieved a Supreme Court victory that overruled Roe and ended the constitutional right to an abortion, anti-abortion advocates are considering what to do next, pursue an all-out ban or continue with a measured approach. Here's Laura Casisto, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Laura, what are you hearing?
So, I mean, this is really a historic victory for them, something that they've worked for 50 years. And for 50 years, the big battle has been putting justices on the Supreme Court, putting conservative justices on the Supreme Court that would overturn Roe v. Wade. With that accomplished, we really have this kind of new 50-year fight, which is all of these different battlegrounds in state houses across the country. This issue is really now going back to the states, and these groups are gearing up for these battles everywhere in all these different states around the country and asking themselves the question, what can we get? How hard can we push? What are the risks if we push too hard?
Okay, so I guess you've asked those questions. What are some of the answers to those questions?
I don't think we know all the answers yet, but I can tell you a little bit about what folks are thinking about. And so we checked in on a number of different states and looked at fights in those states about, again, sort of how far to push. So for example, in Louisiana, we had a very passionate fight this spring about whether to classify abortion as murder. And doing that would mean that potentially women who got abortions could go to prison. And that ended up being defeated, but it was sort of, I think, the opening salvo in a battle over, you know, again, how restrictive to be, how tough to be. We also see fights in states like Louisiana and other places about whether to include rape and incest exceptions. Those were once something that many Republicans said that they supported, but a lot of the more recent laws we're seeing say, you know, even if you're raped, even if, you know, you experience incest, you still will not be able to get an abortion. And that can be quite controversial. Those are very popular with the public. So those are really just kind of a couple examples of the kinds of really deep questions that these groups are grappling with right now.
We're speaking with Laura Casisto, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Her story is called Abortion Opponents Consider How Far to Press After End of Roe v. Wade. You mentioned two politically mixed states like Florida and Virginia.
Yes, I think the hardest question is going to be what to do in those types of states. Florida has a 15-week ban, but the question is, should groups push for a total ban? And that will be something that will be very contentious in the coming months. Florida is one of the biggest states in the country for abortion. It would be a sea change if we were to see abortion completely banned in Florida. And even though you have a Republican governor and a Republican legislature, they're, I think, quite anxious about, quite reticent about going past what they are concerned public opinion might be. Virginia, also a really interesting place. Governor Glenn Youngkin came out on Friday and indicated that he would be thinking about a ban sometime in the second trimester, you know, around 15 or 20 weeks of pregnancy. And we saw some pro-life groups really fire back against that and say, That is not a meaningful change. You are being way too weak on this issue and you should be doing more. But Virginia, again, not a deep red state and a state where I think Governor Youngkin is treading very carefully about how far he can push.
You quoted a professor at the University of California, Davis, who said traditional hierarchies in the anti-abortion movement have broken down as the movement has achieved a monumental victory. Meaning what?
Yeah, so, you know, really for years you had the mainstream groups in the anti-abortion movement saying, we're going to urge incremental change, we're not going to go past public opinion, we're not going to move too far, too fast, and risk backlash either from the public or in the courts. And you have groups that are kind of coming of age now that are saying, look, you told us to be cautious, but look at this victory that we just won by pushing, by taking risks. And we want to continue to take risks. What's the point of having got here if we're going to just push for incremental change? This is our moment. And as I sort of say in the story, I think they both see a moment kind of politically, but they also see a real moral imperative not to be incremental, but to completely ban something that they see as murder.
And for the abortion rights groups, I guess, for their part, do they say, listen, if we want change, we have to vote out all the Republicans at the state level and make our own laws? I mean, that's basically where they are at this point, I guess.
So I would say their goals at this point are like the lap, but I would say more modest. I think they're realistic about what they can do in some of these states. Democrats certainly have not done well in state politics in recent years. But, you know, in some of these places, like Michigan is a good example of this, you don't need a sea change there. You just need a few seats and to hold the governorship and to hold the attorney general's seat. And if you can do those things, then you might be able to change the law in Michigan. And so I think they are really looking for those kinds of realistic places to make some gains.
Thanks, Laura. Laura Casisto, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for being with us. Calling it one of the most brazen terrorist acts in the history of Europe, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky described how Russian missiles hit a shopping mall in central Ukraine. The State Rescue Service says at least 16 people were killed and about 59 injured in the attack on the mall in the city of Kremenchuk. Mr. Zelensky said nearly 1,000 civilians were inside, but many appeared to have managed to escape when an air raid siren sounded. The attack came yesterday as Mr. Zelensky told Group of Seven leaders meeting in Germany that he wants to shorten the war. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
You have courageous people whose country's been invaded who are still willing to fight, and all they're asking from us is help to give them the ability to fight. My attitude is I'm willing to give them anything that'll shoot that they think will be helpful.
U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Washington would provide more support for Ukraine's military. 20 minutes now after the hour on This Morning. Here's Jennifer Koshenka.
And now, the three big things you need to know. Number one.
A grim scene near San Antonio where 46 people were found dead in the trailer of a big rig truck. 16 people, including four children, were hospitalized. San Antonio Police Chief Bill McManus says the discovery was made last evening in an undeveloped area of southwest San Antonio near the railroad tracks.
A worker who heard a cry for help came out to investigate, found a trailer with the doors partially open, opened them up to take a look, and found a number of deceased individuals inside.
McManus says the survivors lacked water and air conditioning. Homeland Security investigations have taken over the investigation.
Number two.
Three people have died and a number of passengers were injured when a cross-country Amtrak train collided with a dump truck yesterday afternoon in rural Missouri, causing several cars and locomotives to derail. ABC's Alex Perez says the train was carrying 243 passengers and 12 crew members when it hit the truck near Mendon.
This is what authorities call an uncontrolled crossing, meaning there were no gates there to stop traffic. The NTSB sending a 14-member GO team to closely examine the scene. They'll even be reviewing cameras from the train itself as they work to figure out what went wrong.
Two people on the train and one person in the truck died.
Number three.
Siding with a football coach who knelt in prayer at the 50-yard line, the Supreme Court has ruled 6-3 that a school district cannot bar him from publicly exercising his faith on the field after the game, continuing a line of decisions lowering the wall between church and state. The court rejected arguments that the public devotions could be seen as coercive to the players. Actress Mary Mara, who guest starred on shows Ray Donovan, Nash, Bridges, and ER, has died in an apparent drowning accident. Her body was discovered in New York's St. Lawrence River on Sunday. State police say the 61-year-old drowned while swimming. There were no signs of foul play. And a comedy legend is coming to Better Call Saul. Six-time Emmy Award winner Carol Burnett will appear as a guest star in the AMC drama's sixth and final season, portraying a character named Marion. Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul will reprise their Breaking Bad roles of Walter White and Jesse Pinkman during the show's Swan Song. The series returns for its final six episodes on July 11th.
And for Carol Burnett, wow, thank you, Jen. Home ownership is a key to building wealth, though high prices have made buying difficult, and younger adults have been delaying home purchases as compared to previous generations. That said, are we headed toward becoming a nation of renters? Here to explore is Charisse Jones, economic opportunity reporter at USA Today. Charisse, set the scene.
Well, you know, there's been a real frenzy the last 2 years because we saw historically low interest rates. And so folks were definitely trying to get out there in the market, buy their first home, move up in their homes in terms of size and value. And it was just incredibly competitive. You had people that were able to bring all cash because they wanted to have an edge up over the other competitive bids that were coming in. You often had bidding frenzies where you had, numerous people that were bidding on the same property. And so it just became harder and harder to purchase a home, especially if you were in that kind of moderate income range.
So explain the story of the young woman named Summer Wren. She says, aha, I've got a good idea. I'll leave expensive New Jersey and move to North Carolina.
Yeah, you know, New Jersey, which is where I live, is very expensive. And she figured she could go back home with her husband. Their money would go further. She'd be able to get a home. She grew up with her mother and stepdad who never owned a home. So buying property was something that was really important to her. And when they got down there, her husband said, well, let's wait a minute. Let's make sure we really want to be here before we put down that money and buy something. And now they're buying, their ability to buy is just shrinking by the day. I mean, they've been pre-qualified for a loan for about $400,000, but that doesn't buy as much as you would think. And so they want to buy a home that's big enough to one day start a family. That might get them, the amount they've been pre-qualified for might get them a two-bedroom, which is not sufficient.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, their apartment rent is potentially going up.
We're speaking with Charisse Jones, economic opportunity reporter at USA Today. Her piece is called, Will We Become a Nation of Renters? As housing prices soared, home buyers struggled. So what about the answer to the question posed in the headline? Is buying a home worth it, I guess? Will we become renters?
Well, buying a home is definitely worth it. But the number of renters is really, as I said, increasing. We've got more than a million more rental households than we had 2 years ago. And again, when you start renting and the rents are higher than they've been, they've gone up about 5.2% this year, it makes it harder to save a down payment. It jeopardizes your ability to get a home if you fall behind in those rental payments, and it potentially creates a group of people that might wind up losing their homes, you know, getting evicted and not being able to purchase properties.
I saw data from Redfin saying that I think about 40% of homeowners right now in some fast-growing Western cities have lowered prices on their homes that they're selling. Is there hope for folks that things will get more affordable, even though the mortgage rates are high?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the inventory is a problem. There's just not enough supply to meet demand. But the market is cooling down. There are fewer bidding wars. One in four homes that have been on the market have lowered their price in the last month. And there are people that are, tapping into programs that can help them get into home ownership.
Thanks, Charisse. Charisse Jones, economic opportunity reporter at USA Today. 30 minutes after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Want to eat healthier, but every supplement you've ever tried seems like the better it is for you, the worse it tastes? Then you have to try AG1 from Athletic Greens. I started taking AG1 because I wanted more energy and better gut health. What I didn't expect, the taste is better than any supplement I've ever had. I drink it, like it says, before anything else when I wake up. I guzzle those 8 to 10 ounces before my coffee and start my day knowing I've already gotten the recommended daily intake of all the good fruits and veggies. There's definitely a mental boost knowing you've started the day off on the right foot. I tackle the day now with more confidence and energy. AG1, by the way, is not only lifestyle friendly, it's cheaper than getting all the different supplements yourself. Try AG1. I love this product. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free 1 year supply of immune supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/Gordon. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/Gordon to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. athleticgreens.com/Gordon.
This is America's First News, preparing you for the day ahead with headlines and in-depth analysis. This Morning with Gordon Deal.
Thanks for being with us. Welcome into Tuesday, June 28. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koshenka, some of our top stories and headlines. Dozens of migrants found dead in a truck in San Antonio. Three killed after an Amtrak train hit a dump truck in rural Missouri. Supreme Court says a high school football coach can pray on the field. Five more states hold primaries today. Some big retailers, including Walmart, are limiting purchases of over-the-counter emergency contraceptive pills as demand spikes. Stocks finished lower. 12 suspensions after a brawl between the Mariners and Angels. And the Stanley Cup gets yet another dent. That story in about 20 minutes. Five of the 35 House Republicans who voted for the original January 6th commission to investigate the attack on the Capitol will be on a primary ballot today. So far, 12 have won or advanced from their primaries, 2 have lost, 9 others retired or resigned. A status update from Annie Linsky, national politics reporter at The Washington Post. Annie, take us through it.
In a number of Republican primaries, one of the critical key issues has become the January 6th commission. Those hearings are going on right now. They've been in the headlines. And there were 35 Republican members who voted for sort of a different iteration of that commission. And nearly all of them are facing primary challengers. And those challengers are sort of making that commission vote a central issue in the campaign.
Yeah, it's interesting because you have this particular subset that voted for the commission, but not necessarily to impeach former President Trump, right? Those folks seem to be really facing some political heat. So this group is slightly different. What's happening in a place like Mississippi? You're profiled there.
Yeah, I mean, Mississippi, and that's one of the races that's going to be decided on Tuesday. I mean, that's, I think, in some ways the most extreme example. You had a Representative Michael Guest. He's a new member of Congress. He's a Republican. He's been there for two terms. He voted for this commission. And sort of out of nowhere, he was primaried from the right by Michael Cassidy, a former fighter pilot, who made Guest's vote in favor of this commission the central issue of the campaign. And it was a huge surprise to observers, but Cassidy actually won the primary. He got 300 votes ahead of the incumbent Republican. Neither got to 50%, so there's a runoff. The runoff election will be on Tuesday and will determine, you know, who advances to the general election.
We're speaking with Annie Linsky, national politics reporter at The Washington Post. Her story is called "They Backed a January 6 Commission. Now they face heat in GOP primaries." You said, too, there is a path to surviving criticism over the vote. Explain that.
Yeah, a number of these races have already happened. I believe it's about a dozen where, you know, Republicans have just been able to fend off attacks from the right that they were not loyal to Trump. You know, what they say is that, look, we wanted a different kind of commission. We wanted Republicans to have more of a voice. I mean, you know, we wanted there to be additional members of the Republican Party involved in this, in a sort of independent outside commission. And they got a little bit of help, oddly enough, from Donald Trump, who has also been, you know, complaining along the same lines about the current commission, saying that he wishes it had been configured differently and that he wishes there were more Republicans on it. So, you know, that's one tactic that these incumbents are using, is to just sort of distance themselves from the current hearings and say, oh, no, this is not what we voted for at all. We voted for something completely different. Also, I mean, look, the ones that have been around longer and have their own sort of brands in their districts are also, you know, able to survive. But you have seen two lose, and you really, it's a big question mark tonight. I mean, if the closest races that we're looking at on Tuesday are the ones in which a Republican is facing a challenge from the right who's made this commission the key issue in the race.
Yeah. How about with Illinois? What's happening there?
Yeah, I mean, you saw, Illinois, you've got a House district where you have two incumbents running against each other. One who voted for the commission, another, Mary Miller, who did not vote for the commission. And you saw Trump over the weekend coming out, you know, doing a rousing rally for Miller. I mean, that is one of the cases and where you could end up seeing one of the commission Republicans, you know, losing their seat. And this commission has been a critical piece of that campaign.
Yeah. You said, too, in Utah, for example, even in races, where it's not a central issue, the vote has come up. Set that scene.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, in Utah, you have two members, actually, who voted for the commission, you know, and both of them, you know, have had to fend off attacks, and they've had to spend time and capital explaining this vote, telling voters that they actually do support Trump. And it's sort of what they've been doing is sort of expressing sort of fealty towards Trump, because their voters cannot be seen as questioning him, even though by taking this vote, you know, it very clearly was an attempt to look closely at what had happened on a day that conservatives want to just move on from.
Thanks, Annie. Annie Linsky, national politics reporter at The Washington Post. By the way, be sure to follow us on social media, including on our newly updated Instagram page. You can find it at This Morning with Gordon Deal. Thanks for being with us. It's been a tough summer for air passengers in the U.S. Many days have seen thousands of flight delays and cancellations, and airlines are taking longer to get their operations back on schedule when things go wrong. A shortage of pilots, while not the only reason, is a major factor. Insight from Zach Wichter, reporter at USA Today. Zach, explain.
It's not the only issue, but it is kind of the key issue. One of the experts who I spoke to for this story said that in the U.S. at least, the pilot shortage is the bottleneck that's kind of causing this cascading effect across the rest of the industry. And the problem really is that airlines in 2020 didn't know what the coronavirus pandemic was going to look like. And so they incentivized a lot of retirements, and some of them did layoffs, and in other cases, some pilots, even who weren't eligible for retirement, decided to leave the industry. Airlines really shrank in 2020 and 2021 when travel demand was much lower than it is now.
All right, so the simpleton in me says, well, go fetch all those ones that were laid off and unretire them, or whatever the case may be, but it's not that easy, I guess.
Right, exactly. Especially for the folks who retired. I mean, some of them may have aged out of being a pilot. There is a mandatory retirement age currently in the U.S. of 65. So if any of those folks turn 65 since they retired or a few years ago, they're no longer eligible.
We're speaking with Zach Wichter, consumer travel reporter at USA Today. He's written a story called Pilot Shortage, Driving Airline Reliability Woes This Summer. How do they fix the problem then, Zach?
That is a good question, and not one that people have a super clear answer to. The airlines are doing their best to recruit new pilots as quickly as they can, but as I said before, that takes time. They've had training regimens in place for a long time to kind of get people through the pipeline as quickly and efficiently as possible, and they're doing their best to recruit from other places, be it the military, be it private pilots who could qualify more quickly to fly for commercial airlines, be it some of the regional carriers who are now losing their pilots to the mainline carriers. It's going to take some time.
Jeez. All right. So meanwhile, kind of personalize it. What's it mean for you and me, the traveler?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I'm flying later, so I'm really interested to see what that's going to look like at the airport.
You'll be the guy with the notebook in your hands?
Yeah, exactly. For the traveler, it means that this summer and possibly into the holiday travel season is going to be a little hairy. Airlines are working hard to make their operations as reliable as they can, but with tight staffing, it can be especially difficult for them to recover when something goes wrong, be it severe weather or anything else. It takes longer to bounce back. So for the traveler, that means you kind of have to be ready for delays, possibly cancellations. It's a good idea, according to some of the folks I spoke to have alternatives in mind if your flight does get canceled, to know kind of what you're going to try to be rebooked on, or to be prepared to maybe rent a car or find some other way of getting there. And also, it means it's more important than ever to plan ahead.
Boy, is anybody kind of painting an optimistic picture, like that things will improve, say, I don't know, in a time for the holidays later this year?
Yeah, I think one of the experts who I spoke to said that by the holidays, things should be smoother. Not perfect. The airlines are still going to be working on recruiting, still trying to get their rosters back to normal. But he said they're learning from this summer about how much they need to pull back their schedules in order to ensure reliability. And between now and the holidays, they'll have more time to recruit pilots.
Thanks, Zach. Zach Wichter, consumer travel reporter at USA Today. How would you love a chance to save some money on car insurance? GEICO can help. Switch today and see all the ways you could save with great rates and discounts. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com to get a rate quote and get started seeing how much you could save. Glad you could be with us, and welcome into Tuesday. 8 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning. Once again, here's Jennifer Koshenka.
And now, the three big things you need to know. Number one.
46 people were found dead last evening in a tractor trailer in San Antonio. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement says the people are believed to be migrants who were transported to the U.S. in a smuggling operation. San Antonio Mayor Ron Nuremberg.
We are dealing with a horrific human tragedy. So I would urge you all to think compassionately and pray for the deceased, the ailing, the families.
16 survivors were transported to hospitals, four of whom were teenagers or young adults. Authorities say three people are in custody but did not provide details on who they were or what they were arrested for, saying the investigation is in the hands of federal agents.
Number two.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russian missiles hit a shopping mall in central Ukraine yesterday, killing at least 16 people and injuring dozens more. Nearly 1,000 civilians had been inside, but many appeared to have escaped when an air raid siren sounded before the missile struck. The strike came before a NATO gathering in Madrid today. Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says NATO will put 300,000 troops at high readiness.
We will transform the NATO response force and increase the number of our high readiness forces to well over 300,000. Our new concept will guide us in an era of strategic competition.
Zelensky met with G7 leaders yesterday, making clear he wants to shorten the war. The Supreme Court's decision to end constitutional protection for abortion has opened the floodgates for a wave of litigation from all sides. Temporary delays were successful in Louisiana and Utah after state judges issued orders yesterday that blocked abortion bans in those states from going into effect, while a federal judge in South Carolina said a law restricting abortions would take effect immediately there. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol riot announced it will hold a new hearing today to present recently obtained evidence and receive witness testimony. The surprise hearing was announced yesterday afternoon. It's not clear what new evidence the committee plans or who will testify. Well, if you don't have much on your list for Amazon Prime Day in July, you'll get another chance. Amazon plans to hold a second shopping event for Prime members sometime in the fall, marking the first time the company will hold two such events in the same year. The first Prime Day will be held July 12th and 13th.
All right. Thank you, Jen. Thanks for joining us. The Colorado Avalanche have joined an elite group of NHL franchises that have won at least three Stanley Cups. They're also now one of the teams that caused damage to the legendary trophy. It was around 10:45 Sunday evening when the final horn sounded, giving Colorado a 2-1 win over Tampa Bay, winning the series in six games. The traditional skate around then ensued, with players taking turns kissing Lord Stanley's cup and raising it over their heads in victory. Less than an hour later, the team lined up for a large group photo, and Nicholas Obey-Kubel tripped as he was bringing the trophy in. It fell, leaving a giant dent in the base of it. It's nothing the keeper of the cup cannot fix. It's fresh off a fix, after all, from last year when Tampa Bay dropped it while celebrating, denting the cup portion of the trophy. The live TV version of the drop by the Avalanche has led to lots of jokes. As one commenter said on Twitter, quote, "If the trophy ain't dented, you weren't celebrating enough." That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.